Harper's Magazine, March 2025, continuing with Under Miscellany, titled New World Symphonies, Listening for the Future of Music by Matthew Sherrill. Continuing on. Thales, Nikola's most modest AI-powered creation, was what is sometimes known as a, quote, composed, end quote, instrument. One whose sound production is independent from the gestures involved in playing it. Thales, for instance, doesn't transmit discrete audio signals, but rather data that can take on a virtually infinite number of sonic shapes. This severing might explain why I heard so many Guthman candidates describe their creations as, quote, controllers, end quote, or, quote, interfaces, end quote. Case in point was Yuan, Y-U-A-N, a, quote, data-driven instrument, end quote, that was the invention of Qi Wang, a professor of music at Indiana University. Yuan was a set of several modified tambourines tricked out with motion and temperature sensors so as to respond to any number of different inputs. Watching Qi perform, tracing wide arcs with the tambourines, or manipulating them on a pulley system she had devised, I had difficulty fully distinguishing her act from choreography or some kind of interpretive dance. The sound, it seemed, was subservient to the act of making it. The principle behind XKI, X-E-K-I, all capitalized, quote, experimental expressive keyboard instrument, end quote. The creation of a three-man team from New York University was not dissimilar, resembling something between a guitar and a trumpet. XEKI was designed to be hoisted on one shoulder and controlled by a series of keys, a movable grip, and the particular orientation of the XEKI in space, each of which modulated a different sonic parameter. Humans are, quote, multimodal, end quote, the aptly named Orpheus Conophingos of the XEKI team told me, quote, end quote. Orpheus was an unmistakable presence at the Guthman, spotting a head of hair that can only be described as Metheny-esque. We want to not only hear sound, he explained, we want to see it. Nor can these two things be neatly decoupled. So experimenting with the expressivity of instruments, the very motions and actions by which they produce sound, is for Orpheus a way of generating fundamentally new species of music, even if the song remains the same. On Saturday morning, the contestants were sequestered for rehearsal with their assigned accompanists in buildings that otherwise house the university's Center for Relativistic Astrophysics, the Photonic Research Group, and the Office of Radiological Safety. The challenges in figuring out just how to properly accompany an instrument that no one has yet accompanied were myriad. Santi was at pains to make the sonograph's unique form of shape-based music notation legible to the clarinetist who would be forming with. Quote, I'll be starting with some stars, end quote, he explained, but not entirely helpfully. Max struggled to find a way to prevent his ethereal vocal cords from being overwhelmed by the performance of his assigned vibraphonist. And Nicola was trying to make sure that the sounds produced by his percussionist partner, by means of, quote, microtonal bowls, end quote, some magnetic spheres, and a ring of keys, were sufficiently, quote, creepy, end quote. Other contestants faced a mismatch in genre. Anthony and his circle guitar were paired with Milk Plus Sizz, a Grammy-winning Atlanta production duo. Their idea was to pair the circle guitar's chordal drone with a club-ready track of their own devising, which I feared might risk complicating Anthony's guitar god dreams somewhat. Quote, because we're young and beautiful, champagne flights, we're living in the moment, end quote. Nevertheless, this didn't seem to bother Anthony, who relished the prospect of a club-style, quote, drop, end quote, whereupon the circle guitar's full and literary revolutionary potential would be unleashed on the world in one singular epiphanic moment. Then there were the technical problems. The Lorenz violin was still plagued by inconsistent intonation. One of Max's three vocal cords had to be replaced after having snapped during its demo the previous day. And Bertie's temperamental battery was acting up again, though you wouldn't know any of this from the backstage atmosphere of unrelenting camaraderie and mutual encouragement. Contestants spoke enthusiastically with one another about, quote, latent space, end quote, and other concepts more suggestive of a computer science conference than a musical competition. The atmosphere was what I suspect chess camp must feel like, the happy sense that one is meeting future pen pals. Nicola to Max, quote, this is so close to being played at gigs. Is it on the GitHub? End quote. Cat to Nicola, quote, would you be down to jam? End quote. Pipa to Santi, quote, I didn't know there were people like us in Spain, end quote. The auditorium that night, though only two-thirds full for the evening's performances, seemed equally enthusiastic. A well-dressed man seated near me, who said that he played, quote, many instruments, end quote, but, quote, mainly guitar and flute, end quote, asked me to take several photos of him in front of the stage, which he then set about furiously texting out to his friends. In the aisle to my right, a young man who I gathered was a member of the esteemed Guthman clan gushed enthusiastically about the press presence, by which he undoubtedly meant the CBS News crew on hand, for whose benefit my own schedule had been constantly and annoyingly tweaked over the course of the weekend. Eventually, Angel Cabrera, the president of Georgia Tech, took the stage for some opening remarks. I had spoken to him earlier in the day and had listened to him both ruminate on the innate human need for musical expression and, somewhat less poetically, compare the Guthman to the television show Shark Tank. Quote, how many times have you watched Star Wars? End quote. He asked the crowd. This year's competition, he promised, quote, is going to put the Star Wars canteen to shame, end quote. Footnote. Various nerds are fond of pointing out that John Williams was purposefully ripping off Benny Goodman when he wrote Episode 4's famed Cantina music. The fact that the songs have an obvious earthy predecessor, along with the fact that George Lucas and company could think of no more creative or less gross terms to describe this genre in-universe than, quote, jizz, end quote, speaks to certain difficulties in imagining otherworldly music. The crew of the Starship Enterprise, after all, still listens to Chopin's nocturnes, despite there being 400 years of presumptive musical history between 19th century Paris and the age of interstellar travel. After a few more remarks, Cabrera headed off stage. The lights dimmed, and the showcase began. Things, for the most part, went beautifully. The Babel table was fittingly paired with a bassoonist who had tricked out her own instrument with a number of effects pedals and seemed to share an instinctive musical language with Jean-Francois. And Nicola succeeded in manifesting full-on haunted cathedral vibes with Thales. Santee and his clarinetist partner had apparently agreed on what a, quote, star, end quote, signified, and he deftly deployed a number of twigs and leaves, as well as a cigarette lighter, on the sonograph screen to the audience's greatest delight. For his efforts, Santee would earn the People's Choice Award. Max channeled his inner Arthur Rushell and delivered a genuinely lovely reverb-drenched aria with the aid of his vocal cords, and the body-mouth dancers crept asymmetrically closer to the borders of intelligibility. The show was not without its missteps. Unsurprisingly, the circle guitar didn't quite sync properly with Milk and Scissors' party track, and the much-anticipated drop landed with a less than earth-shattering impact. Though, in keeping with the song's theme of, quote, living in the moment, end quote, no one seemed to mind. Nor did anyone seem to care that the Lorenz violin never did quite manage to stay in tune with his piano partner, producing, if only accidentally, a quivering, hesitant aspect that I found sort of moving. The bone conductive instrument, though, simply failed to work, and Pippa had to retreat backstage for emergency repairs. Quote, Birdie's battery died, end quote, she later explained. The show had to go on, but in the end, Pippa reemerged, a revived Birdie in her hands, and delivered a performance that, if somewhat musically underwhelming, could not have been more impeccably timed and dramatically satisfying. Soon after, a member of the Guthman family came on stage to deliver the judge's verdict. Third place would go to Nicolas Thales. Second, to Jean-Francois Babel Table. And first, deservedly as far as I was concerned, to Max Vocal Cords. Everyone applauded, everyone seemed happy. Everyone seemed to feel that musical justice had been served, if not quite that we had gazed collectively into the infallible crystal ball. It turned out that the jam session of the future differed more in appearance than in sound. The content had been overtaken by the form. Performance preceded essence. Instruments had given way to controllers, interfaces. Augmentation was the default position. There was something that felt a little sad about this state of affairs, maybe, but there was also something invigorating in its orientation toward life experience. Correction. In its orientation towards live experience. It was as if, in introducing the new modes of performance, their instruments enabled, the competitors were actually validating a much older one. To watch Max delicately handle the vocal cords, or to see Orpheus raise the XEKI triumphantly to the ceiling as it crescendoed, was to be reminded in ways that were alternatingly a little ridiculous and profound of the singular power of the stage. Even if none of the entrants were destined to be the next Robert Moog, I could certainly see why Freeman had earlier brought up his example. He must have known, long before I did, that listening to the future of music unfold might not be half as interesting as watching it. Harper's Magazine, March 2025. Under the heading, Findings. California ground squirrels are carnivorous. Monkeys are faster at spotting a snake among salamanders than a salamander among snakes. Dogs are better than humans at spotting spotted lanternfly egg masses in forests, but humans are better than dogs at doing so in vineyards. Mollusks discovered in the Silurian Herefordshire Langrestad were named Punk Ferox and Emo Vorticladum. Harbor seal mothers prefer to rest on slower icebergs after giving birth and on faster ones during molting season. It remained unclear where the two orcas resident at Marineland Antibes, who under French law must stop performing by the end of next year, would live thereafter, since the government determined that a Japanese zoo was governed by insufficiently strong animal welfare laws, a Canarian park might still require them to perform tricks, and a Canadian bay would have to be enclosed and the whales monitored by veterinarians until they die. Six dead dolphins who washed up in Texas were found to have fentanyl in their blubber. A new crocodile newt that breeds in Hunnessy's rice paddies, Tylotetritum gawaganogenesis, was described. Excessive tearfulness in the right eye of a 55-year-old Japanese woman was traced to supernumerary punctum. A meta-analysis of inequity aversion among blue-headed macaws, blue-throated macaws, bonobos, capuchins, chimpanzees, crows, goffins, cockatoos, gorillas, great green macaws, gray parrots, kias, long-tailed macaques, marmosets, orangutans, owl monkeys, ravens, squirrel monkeys, and rhesus macaques found no evidence that the animals experience envy, though they do in some cases feel disappointment. Chinese university students in positions of advantageous inequity experience more empathy and guilt than they do anger, delight, or shame. Paranoid people show a group of dots are prone to hallucinate, one chasing another. Americans with college degrees are more than twice as likely as high school graduates to have recently used ketamine, which induces zebrafish to keep going rather than to give up when they aren't actually getting anywhere. Damage to the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex impairs one's understanding of when it makes sense to keep waiting. Patience is a mechanism to regulate impatience. Multilingualism precedes less severe autism. Sleep deprivation makes it harder to suppress unpleasant memories. Head injuries may awaken dormant viruses in the brain. And medication may treat those who suffer from disorders that make them smooth-brained. Ice core records suggest that lead poisoning in the Roman Empire lowered IQs by 2 to 3 points. Estimates of the social cost of carbon emissions are likely too low by half. An AI analysis of multiple climate models predicted that by 2060, Europe, most of Asia, most of Africa, and most of the Americas will have warmed at least 3 degrees Celsius beyond the pre-industrial baseline. Warming in the Sierra Nevada was expected to decrease snow cover, but kill bighorn sheep in avalanches at consistent and increased rates. Soccer has been getting faster. Decision-making power in the mission to transport Mars rocks to Earth devolved to Donald Trump. Scientists urge the abandonment of attempts to create mirror life, against which existing life forms may possess no defenses. Physicists detected negative time. Humans prefer prospection to retrospection. Archaeologists speculated that, in the largest known Bronze Age massacre in Britain, attackers killed, butchered, and ate men, women, and children as a political statement. Harper's Magazine, March 2025. Under From the Archive, 1936. Titled The Bureaucratic Sublime by Marquis W. Childs. No news from Washington is so certain to arouse the rage of conservatives as reports of an increase in the army of federal employees bursting out of the District of Columbia. Quote, number of federal workers reaches wartime peak, end quote. Such a headline is sufficient to send the temperature of guardians of the Constitution shooting upward. Conservatives see in such a report only a vast political machine greased with the millions that they each month line the pockets of federal job holders. Those jobs at the Public Works, Works Progress, or Federal Emergency Relief Administrations are made up of, quote, intellectuals, end quote. Not necessarily experts or specialists in a field, though some of them may feel that, but brain workers, men and women trained to think abstractly. They have been drawn from universities and colleges, from advertising agencies and newspapers, from publishers' offices and cooperative colonies, from labor organizations and large metropolitan law firms. Just how large this intellectual sector is, it is impossible to say. But it constitutes an important part of the New Deal. And while there are occasional deserters, the intellectual stratum is enlarging. It is interesting to see these intellectuals multiply in kind, building up their own patronage machines. Most of the intellectuals in the government could be put down as liberals. A few, partly as a result of their Washington experience, have moved farther to the left. And from the beginning, there have been some cynical radicals. But it is a curious fact that certain of these radicals have become so enchanted by authority and privilege that they are now wedded to the service of middle-of-the-road government, bent on saving capitalism from its sins. In the bosom of that government have been anarchists, syndicalists, wobblies, communists, but they have been so well and so long sheltered that they have since faded to a pale pink color and now quite harmless. Indeed, it is difficult to escape the conclusion that the majority of these minor brain trusters have worked to little purpose. Too often, adequate direction has been lacking. Too often, there has been confusion of purpose. Too often, their efforts have been restricted by what politicians consider expedient and necessary. Duplication of endeavor and conflicts of authority have given rise to the more deadly diseases of bureaucracy. Intrigue, inner politics, jockeying for place. And these brain workers have been haunted by the uncertainty of their own position. They are neither fish nor fowl. Without the cloak of respectability that goes with the civil service, or the security of the political appointee who feels he is safe so long as the voters return the party to power. The whims and caprices of a volatile administration have given most of them a deep sense of insecurity. Although many of these intellectuals speak with contempt, or a wary disgust, of the administration of which they are a part, they add, as a devout person would cross himself, quote, "But of course Mr. Roosevelt will be elected again," end quote. One must remember that much of what they have done has been sheer improvisation. They have had to do intensive foraging in a social desert, improvising tools as they went along. There has been no social background, very little tradition or precedent to call upon. And while the average of fools, poseurs, and dilettantes would have surely been no higher than in any private organization of equal scope, it is a curious fact that their errors, their egregious blunders, their stupid posturings have been largely overlooked by that very section of the press that would most delight in discovering them. On every piano in the Western gambling halls, or so the legend has it, was a sign that said, quote, "Please don't shoot the pianist. He is doing the best he can," end quote. It is a sign which, with some alterations, might well be placed on many Washington desks. Harper's Magazine, April 2025. Under the heading, Easy Chair. Quote, "This time is different," end quote. By Matthew Karp. Quote, "This time is different," end quote. With Donald Trump's second term off to a roaring, snorting start, a furious cloud of ICE raids and ICE raid photo ops, tariffs announced and then paused, a funding freeze dramatically imposed and then rapidly rescinded, these words have become something of a media mantra. This time, after all, Trump ran not merely as an insurgent entertainer, an amorphous vessel for free-floating enemy, but as the scarred veteran of a decade-long ideological war, prosecuted and convicted by his enemies, his purposes hardened and sharpened by a thirst for political payback. This time, Trump won the national popular vote by a margin of more than 2 million ballots, thereby claiming a decisive mandate for his return to power. And this time, unlike the disarray and improvisation that defined his first term, Trump has taken office flanked by a disciplined coterie of true believers, chief among them Elon Musk, who are prepared to execute a muscular agenda at home and abroad. This triumphal narrative has found support at Mar-a-Lago. Quote, "This time," end quote, Steve Bannon has boasted of the second Trump transition, quote, "It's more sophisticated. It's got more money. It's got a whole media and influencer ecosystem," end quote. But it has also, revealingly, been enthusiastically adopted by Trump's foes. Ezra Klein, elevated by the 2024 election cycle into the leading voice of today's liberal mainstream, laid out the essentials of the argument in the New York Times just before Trump's inauguration. Quote, "America's institutional storm walls," he noted, "are not in 2025 what they were in 2017. End quote. The Republican Party, once a source of intermittent defiance to Trump, has been thoroughly tamed, if not outright seized, by MAGA loyalists. The liberal and progressive opposition, formally mobilized for, quote, mass resistance, end quote, according to Klein, is now, quote, dispirited and exhausted, end quote. And corporate America, including blue state billionaires from Wall Street and Silicon Valley, no longer treat Trump as, quote, an aberration to be endured or a malignancy to reject, end quote. but as a powerful leader to be recognized and a business partner to engage. The collective result in this telling is a new Trump administration with a vast potential for power and limited constraint, whose future is unknowable but seems certain, one way or another, to leave a profound imprint on American life. Whenever a talking point attains this level of trans-ideological consensus among pundits, uniting New York Magazine, CNN, and the Center for American Greatness, the smart money heads in the other direction. Maybe hard to see right now, with all the musk in our eyes, but in the long run, Trump 2.0 remains less likely to deliver a historic rupture than another episode of dreary, numbing continuity. Trump is now a second-term president. There is nothing unprecedented about this position in American politics. After 1980, only Joe Biden and George H.W. Bush have failed to secure a re-election. From Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, we know quite a bit about what second-term administrations look like in the long, late capitalist era. All four won re-election by larger margins than did Trump, clobbering a moribund opposition party for the second time in a row and cementing what many hoped and feared would be a new epoch in American politics. Epoch. And yet, all four of these second terms, despite their many differences, follow the same broadly deflating trajectory. Initial White House confidence collided with legislative gridlock, then decomposed from the slow rot of scandal. Domestic policy advanced, if at all, through ungainly negotiations and unloved compromises. Foreign policy, a familiar resort of the throttled executive, was given over to grand, though generally fruitless, gestures. Within the ruling party, ideological fervor flagged, rather than intensified. And in the last three of the four cases, the end of the term was marked by an electoral repudiation at the hands of the once feeble opposition. Consider George W. Bush, who won re-election in 2004 by about 3 million votes. His party controlled 55 seats in the Senate and held a robust 30-vote majority in the House. After Inauguration Day, his public approval rating reached 57%. Quote, "I earned capital in this campaign," end quote, a triumphant Bush told the press, quote, "and now I intend to spend it," end quote. He unveiled an ambitious plan to partly replace Social Security with a system of private investment accounts. Yet, despite an expensive public relations campaign led by Karl Rove, Bush failed to win popular support for the scheme. It never came to a vote in Congress, and by late 2005, after the debacle of Hurricane Katrina, the rest of the Bush domestic agenda had withered away. Nothing in his second term matched the achievement of the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts, the No Child Left Behind Act, or the 2003 Medicare expansion. In foreign policy, Bush's second term was defined by the ongoing occupation of Iraq, which was bloody, destructive, and increasingly unpopular, little more than a dull echo of the crusading energy of his first term. Reagan's second term, meanwhile, began with an aggressive bid to slash domestic spending, including plans to cut Medicare, freeze Social Security, and eliminate all funding to Amtrak, along with numerous other federal programs. It ended in Iran-Contra fallout, a growing federal budget, and starry-eyed arms control talks with Mikhail Gorbachev. Trump is neither Bush nor Reagan. Yet there is little reason to believe that he will be immune from the forces that shaped the second terms before him. Erratic bluster aside, he cannot run for a third stint in office, nor does he have anything like a clear successor. In other words, he's already a kind of a lame duck. For a political personality who has already demonstrated a large appetite for campaigning and little interest in governing, it is a good bet that extravagance, confusion, and tumult, eventually giving way to inertia and lassitude, are more likely outcomes than a policy revolution. The makeup of Trump's cabinet has been cited by Klein and others as evidence that his second term will be more unfettered than the first. Yet the likes of Marco Rubio, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and Pete Hegseth do not suggest ideological extremism or even ideological coherence, so much as a mercurial perception of personal loyalty, along with the vague preference for celebrities who look good on TV. Trump's desire to punish his enemies has long been depicted as a sweeping authoritarian threat to democracy. Quote, could he lock them up? End quote, worried the New York Times magazine last fall, referring to such iconic Trump foes as Robert Mueller, James Clapper, and Houman Abedin. Yet a drive for personal revenge, by its very nature, lacks political content. It is definitionally petty. The National Review believes that the removal of Secret Service protection from John Bolton and Mike Pompeo is, quote, gravely serious, end quote. But what is bad news for General Mark Milley's Pentagon portrait may not matter very much to the 300 million other Americans. Ideologically, MAGA world remains the same jumbled stew that it always has been, congregating neoconservatives and isolationists, global corporations and xenophobic populists, doctrinaire libertarians and big government nationalists, anti-woke libertines and evangelical Christians. Musk and Bannon could not make it to the inauguration without crossing swords over immigration. Without the disciplining effect of a re-election campaign, Trump 2.0, like Trump 1.0, promises not cohesion, but volatility and continual infighting. Nor does Trump himself generate the kind of political momentum capable of blasting through his coalition's tangles and conflicts. His Inauguration Day approval rating of 47%, ranked behind even elected President Gallup has racked since 1953, except only his own first term. Trump is, as I write this, posting the best polling numbers of his career, but even so, his net favorability rating of +3% remains well behind the +18% Biden received in February 2021. And the president's signature policy moves, tariff hikes, large spending cuts, mass deportations, remain divisive rather than broadly popular. As in 2016, he owed his 2024 victory not to some grassroots ideological transformation, but to a wave of disgust with the ruling Democratic Party, which has been more unpopular now than it has been in decades. This does not mean that Trump's agenda is dead on arrival in Washington. Far from it. Liberal and progressive causes will suffer. Organized labor will take another drubbing. The investor class will get the deregulatory field day it has been thirsting for. In other words, when the dust settles, things will probably look much like the spasmodic right-wing coalition of government of 2017-18, rather than some unified MAGA autocracy. In the House, Trump's majority is now just 3 seats, much thinner than it had been in his first term. The Republican Senate, meanwhile, may have confirmed Trump's cabinet, but it remains a political world unto itself. We should expect no conspicuous break between the administration and our Republican-led Congress, given their shared interest in cutting taxes, confirming judges, and humiliating the Democrats. But neither will it be easy to push John Thune's Senate or John Roberts' Supreme Court toward a convulsive shift in any particular direction. These right-wing forces, not yet drained of their institutional power, seek to preserve rather than transform America's political, economic status quo. So, too, do the financial titans and tech billionaires who have supposedly kowtowed to Trump since his re-election. Yes, Mark Zuckerberg put Dana White, president of the Ultimate Fighting Championship, on the board of Meta and trimmed a few diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. Amazon paid millions of dollars to make a documentary about Melania Trump. And the CEOs of Apple, Google, and OpenAI attended Trump's inauguration. Quote, "Is corporate America going MAGA?" End quote. Asked an uncharacteristically breathless Financial Times. But these small exuberances do not signal, quote, "a cultural shift in the nation's boardrooms," end quote, of any greater significance than the profusion of corporate DEI programs did after the murder of George Floyd in 2020. Trump is not the master of American capitalism. He is a creature and an occasional mascot. MAGA, world's excitement, yet what amounts to a token embrace from blue state industry moguls. Barack and Michelle Obama, after all, didn't just get a vanity doc, but a production company that provides exclusive content to Netflix, suggests something of the real power relations between the president and the billionaire class. No, whispers of a tremulous voice, this is not just another corporate-led second-term administration. This is Trump. And yet, with this president and the media, quote, "this time," quote, is somehow always different. Trump's political emergence in 2015 was declared a shocking break with history. Quote, "in truth," wrote Adam Gopnik in The New Yorker, "this time is different," end quote. And just as Trump himself was intrinsically other, a departure from all norms and precedents, his story seemed uniquely given to sharp pivots and sudden reversals. In October 2016, pundits hailed the Access Hollywood tape as a scandal unlike the other kerfuffles that attended Trump's campaign. Quote, "why this time it's different," end quote, cried the nation, confident that the leaked audio would doom Trump at the polls. That didn't work out, but Trump's presidency itself produced no shortage of narrative drama. Once again, the plot bent toward the total transformations of the republic, accompanied by the thrilling heralds of Trump's imminent downfall. The new commander-in-chief was, quote, an unprecedented president, end quote, declared The Week in April of 2017. Quote, just 100 days in, it's clear Americans have never seen anything like Donald Trump, end quote. Quote, this time is different, end quote, proclaimed Foreign Affairs, arguing that U.S. foreign policy would, quote, never recover, end quote, from the damage wrought by Trump. Yet, as Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian election interference in the 2016 campaign appeared to gain momentum in 2018, Business Insider reported a dramatic change in the White House. Quote, Trump's friends and allies are worried he's spiraling out of control, and they say this time is different, end quote. By 2019, with the Democrats back in power on Capitol Hill, Elaine Carmack of the Brookings Institute could declare that Congress was moving toward an impeachment vote that would spell doom for Trump. Quote, this time, she promised, is different, end quote. The subsequent impeachment proved an anticlimax. But the advent of COVID-19 promised a fresh wave of turning points. Quote, this is different, end quote, charged the think tank Third Way, arguing that the president's response to the virus had no precedent in the annals of medical history. Yet Trump's same blundering simultaneously invited bold assertions of an imminent demise. The day he suggested that injecting disinfectant might cure coronavirus, Paul Krugman predicted in April 2020 was, quote, the day Trump stopped being president, end quote. Trump was narrowly defeated that November, an unmistakable difference from 2016, but one that did not stop the appearance of yet further differences. Covering Trump's second impeachment trial after the Capitol riot on January 6, 2021, CNN returned to the formula, quote, Republicans acquitted Trump again, but this time is different, end quote. After leaving office, Trump found himself in the crosshairs of federal and state prosecutors, and the story swerved once again. The felony charges brought by the special counsel Jack Smith in August 2023 offered another opportunity for analysts to identify a break with past patterns. Quote, Trump has been indicted before, end quote, ran a Washington Post headline. Quote, historian says this time is different, end quote. The entire 2024 campaign, featuring Trump's criminal conviction in New York, an assassination attempt in Pennsylvania, and a last-minute candidate switch from Biden to Kamala Harris, was one long parade of broken precedents and dramatic plot twists. The past 10 years, in other words, have been an education in difference. And yet, everything about these politics, the appearance of some new Trump shock, the outrage of his foes, the certainty that our conversation will change in another 2 weeks, feels blurrily familiar. In this world, the exhaustion of liberal, quote, mass resistance, end quote, seems less like surrender to a new fascist dispensation than an understandable, even healthy aversion to boarding the same old carousel to nowhere. Perhaps the most fearful metaphor in the age of Trump is not collapse, erosion, or backsliding, but endless spiraling repetition. In other words, the darkest possibility is that this time will not be different at all. Harper's Magazine, April 2025, under the heading Close Reading, title Poetic License, by Walter Benjamin, from, quote, Notes on Baudelaire's Parisian Tableau, end quote, which was published for the first time in English in the fall of 2024 issue of October, translated from the French by Michael Cripper. Baudelaire was solitary in the most terrible sense of the word. Quote, sentiment of solitude since my childhood, despite family and in the company of friends especially, sentiment of destiny forever solitary, end quote. This sentiment bears a social imprint beyond its individual meaning. A digression will briefly clarify it. In feudal society, enjoying leisure, exemption from work, constituted a privilege. Privilege not only de facto, but by law. Things are no longer like that in a bourgeois society. Feudal society could all the more easily recognize the privilege of leisure in some of its members because it had the means to ennoble this attitude and even to transfigure it. The life of its court and contemplative life were two models in which the leisure of the lord, the prelate, and the warrior could function. These attitudes, that of representation as well as that of devotion, suited the society's poet, and his work justified them. In writing, the poet stays in contact, or at least indirectly, with religion or the court, or even with them both. Voltaire, the first of the men of letters in question who deliberately breaks with the church, took refuge with the King of Prussia. In feudal society, the poet's leisure is recognized privilege. By contrast, once the bourgeoisie takes power, the poet is put out of work. It becomes les deux œuvres, quote, the idler, end quote, par excellence. This situation did not occur without provoking notable confusion. There were numerous attempts to escape it. The talents who seemed to be well at ease in their vocation as poets thrived the most. Lamartine, Victor Hugo felt like they were invested with a new dignity. They were, in a certain way, the secular priests of the bourgeoisie. Others, Béranger, Pierre Dupont, were content to rely on catchy melodies to ensure their popularity. Others still, such as Barbier, made the cause of the Fourth Estate their own. Others, finally, Theopoly, Gautier, Le Comte de Lise, found their place in art for art's sake. Baudelaire did not know how to take any of these paths. This was what Valéry said so well in his famous Situation of Baudelaire, where he read, quote, Baudelaire's problem has to be formulated thus. To be a great poet, but to be neither a Lamartine nor Hugo nor Musset. I am saying that this aim was conscious, but it was necessarily in Baudelaire, and even essentially Baudelaire. It was his raison d'être. End quote. One could say that in the face of this problem, Baudelaire decided to flaunt it before the public. He resolved to show off his idle existence, deprived of social identity. He turned himself into a sign of social isolation. He became a flâneur. Here, as for all of Baudelaire's essential attitudes, it seems impossible and vain to distinguish between what had been contingent or necessary, chosen or endured, artificial or natural. In this case, such an entanglement is due to Baudelaire's elevation of idleness to the rank of a working method, of his very own method. We know that in many periods of his life, he was not acquainted with, as it were, any work table. It was by drifting that he fashioned, and above all, that he incessantly rearranged his verse. Harper's Magazine, April 2025. Poem, entitled Eye of Death, by Ariana Raines, from The Rose, which will be published this month by Grey Wolf Press. Me and Amanda went to see David Blaine the night of the Scorpio eclipse. Once again, starting over. Me and Amanda went to see David Blaine the night of the Scorpio eclipse. He held his breath for over 10 minutes in an orb of water. I remember his daughter doing a dance. Then we walked soft through the casino. BBLs and tiny dresses, the lull of slots. And AC. There's a feeling of safety in there, you know, and a powerful idea America hates. That there's dignity. In pleasure. Copious good quality intelligence spent working out the right way to make even me feel happy, floating through the crowd of the unnerving feats of David Blaine. We found our bodies drawn towards an almost serpentine cerebral energy. You could feel it yards away before you saw them, a table of men poring over their cards like nuclear physicists on deadline. Strange electric brain power physically stimulating the ass uncoiled from its tree inside me, drawing up from the pink lights of the money machines to halogen white intensity. When a man dressed impeccably in gray looked up from his cards and stared at me, long and hard. Lock of hair dropped over his brow, he held my gaze till I couldn't take it anymore, and dropped my eyes. Amanda gripped my arm. Wait, were we already walking arm in arm? She, the beautiful, unsteadied me. Did that really just happen? I said. I really did, she did. It really did, she said. Give me a second, I need to catch my breath, I said, staring us cowardly just slightly out of the guy's sight line. I think I understand Dante now, I said, and also Beatrice. Did you know Petrarch's Laura was the great-grandmother of the Marquis de Sade? This is the kind of conversation I make when I'm stalling. What if one look is all you get century to century? Only one poker room in this whole giant casino. This is the era of the starved polar bear and the skinny lion, predators in a growing wasteland devoid of prey. The most famous game, Font of Metaphor, relegated to the back of the hall and only a few tables, and most of them empty. Gargonic eye effing with me. He shot me back into the ancient world, saw me back into poetry. For Amanda Fortini.